Welcome to Voices of the Community, which explores critical issues facing Northern California communities. We introduce you to the voices of community thought leaders and change makers who are working on solutions that face our fellow individual community members, neighborhoods, cities, and our region. This is George Koster, your host. This episode is part of our series exploring COVID-19's impact on nonprofits and small businesses in the San Francisco Bay Area. Back in April of 2020, when we decided to create this ongoing series on COVID-19's impact, first on nonprofits and then on small businesses in the San Francisco Bay Area, we, like you, had no idea how long the pandemic would go on and what the health and economic impact would be in our community. As we enter the second half of 2022 with the latest explosion of cases from the most recent COVID-19 Omicron mutations, along with the masking requirements being changed and folks getting their vaccinations, our communities are still struggling to deal with the health, economic, mental, and societal impacts of the ongoing global pandemic. This all adds to the ongoing uncertainty of our ever-changing indoor and outdoor, vaccinated and unvaccinated protocols, and the politics of the pandemic that will drive how we all come back together as a unified or fractured community. We will continue to shine a spotlight on the nonprofits and small businesses that make up the fabric of our community, along with the founders and staff who are struggling to deal with the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on their operations, services, and sustainability until we can all get to the other side of the pandemic. Along the way, we will also share with you all the amazing solutions that our nonprofits, small businesses, foundations, and government leaders are working on to help us all get to the other side of the pandemic and come together to rebuild our communities with more economic, social, and environmental equality.
It's so necessary for us to kind of move away from stereotypes and myths that are not true around a population of folks that when you ask them, even in supportive housing, do you want to work? 80% say yes. I'm not saying that's for everyone, but I'm just saying it's just an important myth that I think we have to start dispelling.
Throughout this special series on COVID-19's impact on our nonprofits, small businesses, and local governments, we have heard from numerous voices who continue to show up in a pandemic to support our unhoused community members. They have shared with you all the wonderful solutions that our nonprofits and local governments are working on to help reduce the number of our neighbors who find themselves unhoused. As we enter 2023 and the third year of the COVID-19 pandemic, we wanted to hear from one of our government departments about the housing and wraparound support services they are providing to our unhoused neighbors. In this episode, we feature the voices of the Executive Director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing for the City and County of San Francisco, Shireen McSpadden, the Manager of Housing Subsidy Programs at the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, Alan Gutierrez, along with a participant in the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing Flex Housing Pool Program, Jugal Patel, as well as the Executive Director of Episcopal Community Services of San Francisco, Beth Stokes. I'm joined remotely by the Executive Director of the San Francisco Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, also known as HSH, Shireen McSpadden, the HSH Flexible Housing Program Manager, Ilan Gutierrez, along with the Executive Director of the Episcopal Community Services, Beth Stokes, and a participant in the Flexible Housing Program, Jugal Patel. I want to welcome everybody to Voices of the Community today. And our purpose in putting the show together was really to share with our audience and the community what HSH and its partners and participants in the program are doing to address our unhoused community members here in San Francisco. So I'd like to begin by asking each guest to just provide a little background on themselves. So I'm going to start with you, Shireen.
Thanks, George. Good morning. My name is Shireen McSpadden. I am the Executive Director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. I have been with the department for about 18 months. Before that, I was the Executive Director of the Department of Disability and Aging Services. So I've had many years with the city and have been delving into homelessness as a new area for me, but have lots of experience working in city government.
Thank you. And Ilan, would you like to go next?
Thank you, George. My name is Alan Gutierrez, he, him, his pronouns, and I'm the manager of housing subsidy programs at HSH. I've been with the department for just over 5 years, and this was actually my first position with city government. And before then, I spent a decade working in HIV prevention, working alongside queer and trans communities and people in the sex trade in San Francisco in pursuit of increasing their safety and self-determination. And all of that work led me to a common thread of so many people needing housing. And so I joined HSH and have been here ever since.
Thank you. And Beth?
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Beth Stokes, the Executive Director of Episcopal Community Services. I've been with Episcopal Community Services for 5 years now, a little over 5 years. I came from the Corporation of Supportive Housing, and that was out of Los Angeles, where we actually worked on a flex subsidy pool there in the County of Los Angeles. But before that, worked for the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, which was a joint authority of the City and County of Los Angeles. So I was there about 7 years, but before that, spent about 20 years in San Francisco, left for Los Angeles as the executive director of Hamilton Families. And certainly I can't forget that I started out as a social worker with Compass Community Services in San Francisco.
Thank you. And Jugal?
Hello, everyone. My name is Jugal Patel. I am here because I have several years of experience being homeless here in San Francisco. And today I'm involved with several nonprofits that address homelessness, mental health, and addiction issues. And I'm really here to share my lived experience and the effect that this housing subsidy program had on building the life that I have today.
Thank you. So I'm going to turn back to you, Shireen, and have you provide the audience some background on kind of the why San Francisco Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing was created. As we were talking before we came on, it's this kind of combination of creating of four different agencies or organizations brought into one umbrella organization.
Sure. So the department was formed under Mayor Ed Lee, and it was formed back in 2016. And the thinking behind it wasn't just the mayor, but it was a number of people in city leadership at the time. We're kind of thinking about how do we make sure that these services for people experiencing homelessness are really coordinated in the best way possible. So the services were kind of split out between four different departments: the Department of Public Health, Human Services Agency, Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development, and at the time, Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And so the thinking really was that these programs are too disparate and they're all meant to serve the same population, and that is families, youth, and adults experiencing homelessness. And so the department was formed in 2016. For San Francisco, that means we're a very new department. We're one of the newest departments that have been formed. And so it takes a little bit of time for new departments to get their legs and really be able to function along with departments that have been more established. And so that's what we've been working on. We're a 7-year-old department, which is fairly young by San Francisco standards.
Thank you. And I'm turning to you, Ilan. Can you share with the audience, what is the Flexible Housing Program and why was it created?
Thank you, George. The Flexible Housing Subsidy Pool Program combines a rental subsidy, housing location services that are designed to support someone with identifying a unit in the private rental market, as well as ongoing case management services that are really there to ensure that after someone is housed, that they're able to maintain their housing and connect with resources and communities wherever they decide that they want to live. Because the Flexible Housing Subsidy Pool uses units in the private rental market, we're really uniquely positioned to scale this program as new funds become available, whether they're local, state, or federal funds. I think also important because it does take a fair amount of time for new construction to materialize. The Flexible Housing Subsidy Pool really enables us to start much more efficiently than when we're building a new site, just as we do for our site-based permanent supportive housing.
And so how, just to follow up for a second, Ilan, how would someone participate, if you will, in the Flexible Housing Program?
So the flexible housing subsidy pool, folks end up getting referred to that in a number of different ways. Most recently, San Francisco's response to the COVID-19 pandemic led to the city opening over 20 what we call shelter-in-place hotels, and which in many communities, they're called non-congregate shelter. After sheltering thousands of San Franciscans who were vulnerable to COVID-19, we had a new mission, which was to support as many of those guests in the shelter-in-place hotels with finding a permanent home. And so most recently, the primary way that individuals are getting connected to the flex pool is by being referred through those shelter-in-place hotels. Going forward, we're really excited about launching a flexible housing subsidy pool for youth as well as for families. And our newest flexible housing subsidy pool program is geared towards individuals and households in the Bayview District of San Francisco.
And staying with you, Ilan, how many community members have participated? You may or may not have this number, but do you have a kind of a range of the number of folks who are unhoused, both youth, adults, et cetera, that have been able to be helped or participating in the Flex program?
Right now, there's been over 350 individuals housed through the Flex pool, and that our flex pool right now that is the most mature in its age is the flexible housing subsidy pool for adults. So our newest programs that we're standing up, which are population specific, are for youth and for families. And those are just ramping up. So there have not yet been any move-ins at this time, but we look forward to launching those programs in the months ahead.
Great. Thank you, Ilan. Turning to you, Beth, can you provide the audience some background on the Episcopal Community Services team?
Yeah. So in partnership with HSH and other partners who are involved in this, it really is a community-wide effort with the Flex Subsidy Pool. ECS did in the first phase. It goes in phases. So in phase one, ECS was tasked with our partner agencies to house 60 participants. In phase two, that's 70 participants. And so currently we have 90 active participants, either in housing or in a housing search. That's not the total number of people that have gone through the program, but that's the current group that's active. I would say that the program and ECS was just super excited about the flexible housing subsidy program, having seen it work in Los Angeles and also understanding as a developer, ECS in partnership with Shireen and her team. And MOHCD just developed one of the larger supportive housing sites at 256 units of supportive housing. And we know that that cost a lot to build in terms of capital, as Ilan was stating, to underscore that it's about $120 million just for the capital to construct a property. And in supportive housing, there's three legs to that stool, and that's the capital typically, that's the subsidy and the services. But with the flexible housing subsidy pool, you're looking at the subsidies and the services. So you're cutting out the capital, which is really a huge expense and takes a lot of effort and a lot of different funding sources to pull that together. So this is a way to optimize housing and what resources the city and county of San Francisco has committed to this program very quickly. There's an urgency, right, to house folks that are experiencing homelessness on the street. And we have to think in ways that assist us in doing it faster. And I would say the real kind of key to success, literally the key to getting into a house, is that the flex subsidy program, the success starts with the landlords, right? The landlords are one of the most significant partners in making this happen because we rely on them to be able to kind of open their doors and allow folks that have experienced often chronic homelessness, disabling conditions, who are older, to be able to move into properties that they own. And so for us, that we're working with 28 different landlords right now, and that's our current tenants are housed with 28 different landlords. That's not the totality of the pool that ECS works with. We're actually working with pretty much double that number of landlords. And the landlords share with us that the reason they really love this program is that there's certainly an altruistic element that they really want to help the city and county in which they live and own property to address the issue of folks experiencing homelessness. But they're also assured consistent rent. That's super helpful. They appreciate the responsiveness of the team. HSH, Ilan and his team has really helped set up a successful program by providing funding for staffing. We have the ability to respond to a landlord 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that's really another key to the success or tool in the toolbox for this program in order for it to be successful.
That was great, Beth. I want to do a couple follow-ups. First, besides just housing, what are some of the other wraparound services that your organization provides our unhoused community members?
Yeah, I'd say other BCS provides interim housing in partnership with Shireen and her team. We also provide behavioral health services and supportive housing and interim housing. We have a healthy aging program. So we have a senior center, we do healthy aging work. We also provide workforce development. We have a very kind of successful initial pilot where we're paying folks for their training in workforce development and really getting folks who are experiencing homelessness actually in jobs. Our average wage is $23 an hour. We're super excited about what that's showing and hoping to grow that. We also do a lot of work with rapid rehousing, as Jugal will talk about his experience with that program. And I think that's another really important intervention for a large group of people experiencing homelessness in San Francisco. We do think that workforce has to be matched with rapid rehousing because it is a short-term subsidy intervention and just requires a lot of support around helping people find sustainable employment that can help them with a livable wage. And so that's an important part of what we do. We develop housing. So we partner often or we rehab new projects, ECS in partnership with Shireen. And MOHCD and the mayor of San Francisco has 2 home key sites. So we're currently in the process of doing occupied rehab at the Granada Hotel as well as the Diva Hotel. And that's a little bit about what we do, case management services. And for this program, one of the key ones that we have is kind of the land with housing search and finding the housing, but it's landlord relation specialists. And it's folks that are doing the kind of coordination of support services that folks need. You know, our specialists, you know, work hard to recruit landlords. That is something you have to pay a lot of attention to and put a lot of time into. It's not easy work. You know, they manage part of the support, comprehensive support services and the program, and Alon can speak to this as well, across the continuum of providers, but it's really managing issues with landlords as well. It's like you really have to be there for them. But I think that, you know, what makes this program really successful and kind of easier for folks to use is that we are getting the housing. You know, 91% of the folks in ECS's program are in San Francisco. So you have to be much more responsive than you would think you typically have to be in a, you know, we have to respond in single site project supportive housing, but out in the community, you really have to be there for the landlord as well as for the tenant who was formerly unhoused.
And Beth, staying with you for a second, could you share what would be, because I think what I'm also hearing you say is the hard part is, of course, getting landlords to come on board, right? Because it is out there in market rate housing land. Could you share, is there a kind of typical a profile, if you will, of a landlord?
Yeah, I mean, what I can say is that we are not typically dealing with kind of large site landlords. We are having more success with smaller site landlords. They're more responsive to some of the incentives that are provided to them. There's a provision allowed by HSH of $1,000 for the first placement to the landlord. So it's important that we have incentives for them to sign up and to make their units available. And it's typically kind of the smaller landlords. It's not those big conglomerate management companies from our experience that are signing up to participate. And then landlords also, they receive another $500 incentive for subsequent placements. And again, like I said, that's going to be more attractive to some of the smaller landlords, which I think is in many ways a good thing that we develop more of a personal relationship with these landlords versus some very large property management corporation.
Right. And Beth, when you say small, is that like a 4-unit, 6, 8, 10?
In San Francisco, small can mean 30 units. You know, some of these conglomerates have so thousands and thousands of units, and some of the buildings could have 200 to 300 units. So, and I know Alon could speak to this a little bit more about the profile across the continuum of providers. But for us, sometimes it is folks that might have more than 30 units, more than 40 units, yet also it's going to be folks that might have a fourplex or might have a duplex available. But it is studios is the bulk of the type of unit that we're able to move folks into.
Thanks, Beth. So turning to you, Jugal, could you share with the audience your experience? I know you're unhoused, but if you will, your pathway into housing?
Yeah, I'd love to. It was a long path. And there were a lot of steps along the way. And there were a lot of organizations that helped at key moments. What I will say about the housing subsidy is that if I could point to a single resource that benefited me the most in my transition from being on the street to being in a shelter to being institutionalized to finally getting into my own housing that I have today, it was a housing subsidy program because it was the longest lasting. It was from April, May of 2020 until October, September of 2021. So it carried me through a lot of milestones in my life. And all of these milestones occurred because I had a stable roof over my head. And I really can't emphasize enough how essential it is to have a safe space that feels like home to lay my head in order for me to rebuild my life. And how I kind of got into the housing subsidy in the first place was also like started actually when I was in the shelter system, where there was this incredible woman and it was just perfect time for me. I was looking for the job. The pandemic was just starting to be in full force in early 2020. And I really wanted to have a safe home to be in. Yeah. And she told me about it and I applied and I got in the program. And it was such a relief on my shoulders because I hadn't had such a long promised stability of any part of my life in so long. And then now I had this home, which was, it was a really small kind of, as you were talking about before, how small are these units? This house was pretty small. I mean, it had like 7 beds or something, very direct relationship with the landlord. I was right on Noe Street, which is this beautiful, broad, tree-filled boulevard in DuBose Triangle, which is really close to Castro, which is kind of where my community center is. And as Matt had been mentioned before, like there's such a power in being able to live in the community that I want to live in. Like that's huge. And the way that I was able to really start building those roots and build that community was when I had this housing subsidy and I started living in this area.
Thank you. Can I turn back to you, Shireen? Because I would love for you to share with the audience what's been the COVID-19 pandemic impact on HSH's ability to serve and provide services to our unhoused community member.
Sure. So COVID obviously threw some real challenges at us. And I think that one of the great things that happened during COVID was we really had a chance to try out some new things. And the biggest thing that we got to do really was to move people into hotels. So I think this may be common knowledge, but during the beginning of COVID, a number of the hotels were obviously immediately hurting because tourism wasn't happening. And the state really understood that there was an opportunity to partner with hotels and support them and keep them, you know, alive as businesses, but also to really help protect people experiencing homelessness from COVID. So people living in congregate hotels were no longer safe because those congregate environments were really dangerous. And then for people on the street experiencing homelessness, we were also able to address that. So we actually at one point, I believe, had like 25 hotels with people in them. It was a very successful program. And after that, we were able to really work with people to offer them permanent housing. So it was surprisingly successful given the challenges that were thrown at us. And part of the reason we were able to do some of these things is because we were in a state of emergency and therefore able to move very quickly. One of the things that we have noted in our last point in time count that we did in earlier this year in 2022 was that we actually saw a reduction in unsheltered homelessness and overall homelessness. And while the numbers were small, we were one of the only cities on the West Coast that actually was able to say that.
Well, and Shireen, staying with you, could you share with the audience what the point in time, why it's required? And then I think another really good part of that report was your findings and how we're using those findings going forward.
Sure. So the point in time count is required. It's a federal requirement for any county or entity receiving federal funds. What it does really is allow us to count people experiencing homelessness on the street and in our shelter system. And we have various ways of making sure that we capture the numbers as correctly as possible. But it's a point in time, which means it's a one night count. And we do it at night because that's generally when people are moving around less. We feel like it's more accurate. Really what it does, it doesn't necessarily tell us about how many people there are in any given year who are experiencing homelessness in San Francisco, but it points to trends. So we do this, we use essentially the same methodology every 2 years. And so it tells us if we're seeing an uptick or a downturn in the numbers. And it's accurate in that sense. So this time we saw a trend downward, which was really exciting for us. And I think some of the things that we noted during COVID, we really haven't had the chance, I think, to really look at permanent supportive housing, especially when you look at buildings, right? I know we're talking about flexible today, but when you look at some of the place-based options that we have a pretty old housing stock of SROs, and those have been really quite adequate for a long time. But when we were using the hotels, it was really clear to us that for people who have their own bathroom, that was a huge thing for people, just the dignity of having your own bathroom and not having to go down the hall and share with other people. There's a safety. There's certainly, we serve a number of older people and people with disabilities for whom it's difficult to share a bathroom. But moving into the future, we've discovered that fortunately, because of the dollars that we've had and being able to braid some funding, we've been able to buy buildings that have better amenities than some of our older housing stock. So things like that have been really helpful lessons. So those are just a few.
And could you share with us the numbers? Because the last point in time was 2019, before the pandemic. And then normally every 2 years, it would be 21, right? But then that was postponed because of the pandemic. And then you did it again in 22. So when you say the numbers went down, can you provide some context of the numbers?
Yeah. So I believe it was 3.5% reduction in overall homelessness, 15% reduction in unsheltered homelessness. And the 15% corresponded with an increase in the shelter-in-place hotels. So we know that program was very successful in getting people off the street because we saw that that change kind of corresponded to the reduction on the street.
All right. Thank you, Shireen. Turning to you, Beth, how did COVID, or how has COVID, since we're still going into our third holiday with now a triple-demic, how has COVID impacted your organization's work?
Yeah, I mean, I think like everyone, ECS had to pivot, right? We had to very quickly mobilize as an organization around what was in front of us. We had to be extremely resourceful and very nimble. Like everyone, we were almost in competition for supplies in the very beginning. And I would say for ECS, our staff are gritty, committed, and we're working through a pandemic at the risk of themselves and their family. There was a lot of fear, like in the beginning and throughout, around folks' health and wellness. And we tried to mitigate that as best we could. So I think as an organization, I think we've grown. We understand kind of the need to partner with healthcare more closely. I think that was one of the biggest lessons that came out of it for us is we need access to healthcare very quickly at times. And really trying to build those partnerships, both in the public sector as well as with other community-based healthcare centers, because resources were limited. So you just have to do the best you can. But I think the biggest thing was what a community can do when the resources are there to really kind of successfully start decreasing the numbers of folks that are unhoused. Like it's possible, right? And I just think there's more experimentation. I think coming out of it now, there's more of a willingness to look at different housing models. There's an urgency to figure that out in terms of innovation. I think the status quo, as the governor has said recently, is not acceptable anymore. And we all understand that coming out of COVID. I think we understood it before, but we really understand it now is that I just think we all have to work together. I think San Francisco did that. We can do it more. We have to address the issues of inequity, right? We saw the need there. And like, we've got to get the most vulnerable into this housing immediately because of COVID. And that was done very quickly. And I'll say, because I know Trent and his team at HSA were a big part of that effort.
Thank you, Beth.
You're listening to Voices of the Community, which explores critical issues facing Northern California communities. Voices of the Community is supported by a grant from the James Irvine Foundation, dedicated to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. More at irvine.org. This is George Koster, your host, and if you're just joining us, this is our one-hour special show featuring the voices of the Executive Director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing for the City and County of San Francisco, Shireen McSpadden, the Manager of Housing Subsidy Programs at the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, Alan Gutierrez, along with a participant in the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing Flex Housing Pool Program, Jugal Patel, as well as the Executive Director of Episcopal Community Services of San Francisco, Beth Stokes. Let's get back to our conversation about how HSH and Episcopal Community Services are providing housing and wraparound support services to our unhoused neighbors through their Flex Housing Pool program.
Elon, turning to you, how has COVID impacted the flexible housing program? And I think to Beth's point, the inequity, if you will, of racial handicap folks, et cetera.
Thank you so much. There's so much to say on this, ranging from the ongoing fluctuation in the private rental market in the San Francisco Bay Area. That's been huge. We've seen periods of time during the pandemic where rents were lower than they had been for years. And then we saw those rent amounts increase. And there's that oscillation that our amazing nonprofit partners are navigating. Also, just from a sort of financial standpoint too, they're doing their really incredible work to negotiate leases with lands in partnership with the tenants that they're supporting and helping to get housed. And our partners are navigating something that we have really don't have a lot of control over. And also during the pandemic, there's been an increase in resources to support programs like the Flexible Housing Subsidy Pool, as well as Rapid Rehousing. We've talked a little bit about Rapid Rehousing, which is similar to the Flexible Housing Subsidy Pool, except with Rapid Rehousing, the subsidy is not ongoing. It's usually like 1 to 3 years and combines workforce development services so that someone is eventually able to transition off the subsidy and continue to pay rent and afford either the home in which they are currently at, or sometimes they relocate to homes that are a bit more affordable, or if folks want to move somewhere where there can be closer to community, we see some of that. But there's just been a saturation of resources, which is really exciting. And so we're really grateful to our nonprofit partners for their work coordinating with each other through their housing and unit acquisition work and just supporting each other and sharing resources. That's been huge. As it relates to racial justice and ensuring that our programs are really equipped for serving Black, Indigenous, people of color, people with disabilities, queer and trans communities. I think when we talk about equity, it does mean sometimes we're providing a deeper touch to somebody, right? It does mean that sometimes we're going to pay a deeper subsidy for someone who's living with a disability and needs a role in power, because that's what it's going to take to ensure that person their dignity and their safety in their homes. And so we thought a lot about how we go deeper in providing that equitable sort of support to somebody. Sometimes means we're going to make sure that someone who's working on their housing search, they really need to be a part and sort of housed in a specific neighborhood because of their safety issues. And so those are just a couple of examples of what we've done around the racial justice front. And of course, it's the lens and framework through which we do all our works.
Thank you, Elon. Jugal, I wanted to turn to you and have you share with us, how has COVID-19, the pandemic, ongoing pandemic, impacted you on your pathway through housing and job, et cetera?
Yeah, that's, you know, as I had mentioned before, I started with the housing subsidy and getting my own place for the first time in many years in the middle of the pandemic, in the very early days in the pandemic. It was kind of chaos at the facility that I was in because like no one knew what to do. Like we didn't know if we were going to be allowed to leave. We didn't know if we left to go somewhere we felt safer, we'd lose our bed. So it was chaos and no one knew what was going to happen or what to do. And the housing subsidy like gave me a stable place where I knew what was going to happen in the middle of all of that. Like we were a couple months in, realizing that like this is going to be an indefinite experience. We just really didn't know how long it was going to take. And then also I got a job at a grocery store because that was the only kind of jobs that you could get at that time as a starting position. That was all that was available when I'm going out to get my first job that I haven't had in so long. So it was an intense time for everybody, obviously, but I was working at this grocery store where we like the COVID regulations are changing all the time and everyone's wearing masks all the time and people are scared and not even wanting to come in, but they have to because you have to get food. But, you know, as I had mentioned before, like my housing was set. I didn't have to worry about that anymore. It took me through to the end of my subsidy. And like, I really lived my COVID experience in this housing that I got through this subsidy. And then my whole grocery store career, so to speak, and my school career of doing school from home, obviously, because the campus was shut down. So I finished my finance degree in that room that I got through this housing subsidy. And then moving on from there, when the housing subsidy was up, I had saved money. I had met people in the community that helped me then go get my own place. I took another big risk in leaving my comfortable COVID era job, my first job that I got, my first housing, to then getting my own housing on my own, going into a new field in tech. And then eventually starting my own company in that field, also within this last year. None of that would have been possible without having this safe space during all of this like collective traumatic experience that we were going through with COVID.
Thank you, Jugal. Great story. All right. So I want to turn to our next topic and ask each of you, and I'm going to start with you, Shireen, on this one. If you could share a story with the audience that you feel kind of exemplifies the impact of your work on our unhoused community members.
Sure. So I have a friend who I have actually known for many years who, because I met her when I was at the Department of Disability and Aging Services, and she's a person experiencing disability and now she's aging in our system. And she's somebody who has some mental health challenges, uses a support dog to help her make it through her days and things like that. And I think there are many places where she would not thrive. But in San Francisco, she has really taken advantage in every positive sense of that phrase of the services that we have. She's been in community services with other people who she feels like a sense of community with. She has housing thanks to the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, and she really is a thriving member of her community. To me, that's a real success story, and it's a real tribute to the excellent programs that we have in San Francisco, that when they're coordinated like that and they surround somebody with the various pieces that we all need to thrive, that's when you really see our system working well. And so I think she's a real testament to what we can be in San Francisco.
Thank you, Shireen. Ilan, would you like to share a story of what you feel is a great example of how HSH's work and its partners impact people?
So many stories come to mind. I think that one of my passions at HSH is really around the work of cultivating genuine partnerships with our nonprofit partners. I think that there's really a transformative effect when local government and nonprofit partners can collaborate and make decisions together. And we often want the same things. And that's something that I really learned through the 100-day challenge, where there was so much going on during the COVID-19 pandemic, and we were able to accomplish so much together and secure tens of millions of dollars to get these programs off the ground. And through sharing a really compelling story about what our vision was and where we just trusted each other to really, like, we can't all as individuals do everything. And at the end of the day, I think that's one of my career highlights.
Thank you, Ron. And Beth, coming to you, could you share a favorite story?
Well, I would say in terms of favorite story, it's right here. It's Jugal is one of them. And I know that ECS it's just one piece, one step, and there was multiple folks who contributed to that really challenging effort to get into housing when you're unhoused and you're dealing with so many other things that you have to address. And I think ECS has long been an advocate, and certainly since I've been here, of rapid rehousing as an absolutely necessary intervention that communities have to commit to for the bulk of those who are not going to be eligible for supportive housing. And so I look no further than Jugal, and to say that we're so proud of the partnership with HSH and HSH's willingness to go out there and commit to rapid rehousing. And also for us to, I'll say another piece of it, what ECS impact that I think is significant is I think it's like 30 folks that have gone through our new workforce program, because I like to dispel this myth that folks that are experiencing homelessness do not want to work. I came to ECS because of a small workforce program they had, honestly. And I was like, that's always the elephant in the room. Outside of being able to secure subsidies, because San Francisco's commitment to subsidies, either flexible housing or rapid rehousing, is young, right? It's youthful in its iteration. And I think that these are the types of programs that can be scaled quickly I think with closer connections and building the bridges with workforce development, I think we can go really far, right, in getting people who are experiencing homelessness who are not going to be eligible for supportive housing into independence, into choosing communities that they want to live in, their communities. And they're so important because it's so necessary for us to kind of move away from stereotypes and myths that are not true around a population of folks that when you ask them, even in supportive housing, do you want to work? 80% say yes. I'm not saying that's for everyone, but I'm just saying it's just an important myth that I think we have to start dispelling.
Agreed. And I think to your point, Jugal's a wonderful example of that. So Jugal, turning to you, would you like to share a favorite story of your travels over this last 3+ years?
Gosh, it's so hard to pick one. I will say that I think I mentioned my relationship with Cricket earlier, and I think just the through line that both of our journeys have taken together and kind of growing her and her growing her journey of wanting to be as impactful as possible in helping house people here in San Francisco and really everywhere. I mean, her view and mission is endless. I think she'll always keep reaching to do more and reach more people, as well as mine starting with her just reaching out to me in that shelter to connect me to the first resource and the first community that helped me get back, and then helping connect me further to the housing resource. And it's just been so fun. We still meet for coffee every once in a while. And I remember I brought her to the tech house that I was working out of in my first tech job. It was this like scrappy little group of young tech kids. And I was like, you have to come see the house. And I introduced her to like the other kids that were there working with me. And it was just like, it's so wonderful, like being able to like walk that journey and like progress and have someone that's seen you from there and then come to where I am now. And the list goes on and on. And all of these nonprofits and all of these communities, guess who runs them? The people that run them and serve our community and help people come up are the people that have experienced it themselves. So they are the backbone to helping people out of these situations and serving our communities. They are not a drain.
Thank you, Jugal. Very nice examples. And I want to stay with the idea of community engagement. And so, Beth, I'm going to turn to you and ask you to share with the audience, how can folks who are listening to the show today support your work, whether it be volunteer, donate, landlords, et cetera?
Well, of course, as the executive director, I'll always say, please donate, please contribute. But that's to ECS and all the nonprofits. We're never going to receive 100% funding from our public partners. And that's not how nonprofits are. That's not the business model anyway. But we absolutely need support. And I would say we definitely need landlords. We're always open to landlords who are interested in the flex subsidy model, the rapid rehousing model as well. That is a daily fee is the recruitment of new landlords who want to participate. So always looking for that. And there's multiple opportunities in supportive housing. We have the Interfaith Winter Shelter. Every year, we're looking at folks helping for meal preparation or coming by the site to help folks as they're experiencing homelessness and actually don't have a place in shelter and are using the Interfaith Winter Shelter. So we're always looking for volunteers in that program. But I think for the community, it's really to participate. If there's something that you want to learn, please reach out. We do at times struggle with siting projects or getting folks into housing because folks don't really understand the experience of homelessness. Community members sometimes really struggle with folks that were formerly unhoused being their neighbor. And I'm always open to having that conversation with community members to learn. There's so many different resources out there and happy to send them to you for folks to really learn about a new neighbor that has experiencing homelessness living next to you and how your new neighbor and them can support each other. And that happens every day in our community and communities across the United States. And so I just think that there's a lot of needs to be done, right, for us to continue to support each other, educate each other, to listen with grace and patience as people try and understand, but also to know that folks need to be housed in communities that have experienced homelessness. And that's not something that any of us are backing away from, but we're happy. I'm happy to have conversations and be invited to community meetings to talk about it.
Thank you. And Beth, if someone wanted to reach out to you, they send you an email, go to your website if they wanted to donate.
You know, people could go to our website to donate for sure. And if someone wants to reach out to me, they can always email me at bstokes@ecs-sf.org.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Beth. And Shireen, I mean, HSH is a city/county of San Francisco department, but folks could also get engaged in supporting your work as well. Could you share with the audience a little bit about how folks who are listening could support the work?
Sure. Yeah, there are a number of ways that people can support our work. And I would say the number one way is to reach out to a nonprofit like ECS and volunteer your time or donate. All your nonprofits all need public support. Many of them have donor bases and have active donor engagement programs and things like that. And a lot of them have volunteer opportunities. I think that there's a really good opportunity for people to learn a lot about homelessness from people who've experienced homelessness or who are. And that's the best way to do that. I think the other way is really for those people who understand how important it is for us to house people in San Francisco. It's to talk to your neighbors and friends about the importance of programs like our Flex Pool and encourage neighbors and friends to be very open to what San Francisco is trying to do with respect to geographic diversity and housing people throughout our community. I think just to Beth's point, people often struggle with understanding what it means to have people who've been formerly unhoused living near them. And I mean, as we've heard from Jugal, that people's experiences are really different and their ability to engage in community are really different, just like everybody else's. I've heard people say, oh, but seniors and children live near here. And it's like seniors and children are often experiencing homelessness as well. Young adults in school are experiencing homelessness. It's not like homeless people are not us. And I think it's really important for people to engage in that conversation in the city, because so often we fall into some very stereotypical thinking and it's not helpful. So I think those are two ways that people can be engaged.
Thank you, Shireen. And staying with you, Shireen, we recently here in San Francisco had our 2022 midterm election. One of the items was Prop C on the ballot. If you would share with the audience Prop C and its impact on HSH and what you guys will be doing going forward into the new year.
Sure. So the ballot measure that was just passed, Prop C, creates a commission that will provide commission oversight or citizen oversight to the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. San Francisco has commissioned government, so this is nothing new. When the department was formed in 2016, it was formed without a commission, but it is very common for departments in San Francisco to have a commission. What it will do is create a 7-member commission that will provide oversight, and it'll have 4 appointments made by the mayor and 3 by the Board of Supervisors. It has some other stipulations for specific membership slots. For instance, there has to be someone with lived experience on the commission. I think what it really, to me, and I worked with a commission when I was at the previous department, to me, what it really does is highlight publicly the work that we're doing. I don't know that it'll change anything in terms of how the department operates, but what it does do is make it very public and clear how we're handling things, from contracts to just strategic planning, all the different interventions that we have, how they work, how many people we're serving, how the dollars are being spent. And I think it's actually a real opportunity to educate the public about the good work that the department is doing and the good work that our nonprofit providers are doing. And so I see it as nothing but a positive thing from that perspective. And I think that definitely also adds some work, because preparing all those materials and everything for public consumption is a lot of work. But we're prepared for this. We've been planning for it, and we'll see how it goes.
Thank you, Shireen. All right. So moving to our final question, and we've been doing this series, as I mentioned before we came on, it's almost since April of 2020, just on COVID-19. And I've been asking the same question of everyone over 100 episodes now, and that is, what are some of the positive or good things that have come out of the pandemic that's still ongoing? And so I'm going to ask each of you that same question, and I'm going to start with you, Elon.
Thank you. Some of the positives out of the pandemic, there has been in San Francisco a massive expansion of site-based permanent supportive housing, as well as our scattered site housing programs. When I first started at HSH, there wasn't even a flex pool 5 years ago. And now there's over 1,000 slots. There's flexible housing subsidy pool for 4 different populations that are coming online right now. And so essentially we've really, I think, through the pandemic and through really significant investment of local, state, and federal dollars, been able to bring online a massive influx of scattered site and site-based permanent supportive housing so that we can continue our focus on reducing and ending homelessness in San Francisco, and in close partnership with the folks that we are here to serve, as well as our nonprofit partners. Thank you, George.
Thank you, Elon. And Jugal, turning to you, what do you feel has been some of the positive things that have come out of this pandemic? As you've shared your stories, or are there other new positive things or positive things you see coming out of it for not only yourself, but also other unhoused community members?
Yeah, I think personally, the relationships that I just have built during this time have been really deep and long lasting, especially during that first year of COVID. There were only so many people that I was able to see on a regular basis. And those relationships that I built at that time are ones that I still carry through today and ones that I still lean on today. So I think it forced all of us to go a little bit deeper with each other than we normally would, because we were all experiencing something so significant at the same time in a lot of similar ways. As far as the community build, I think it has just blasted the door open on how large communities, like community outreach, can be. Because now, like, let's say I know someone in a different geographic area that is struggling with some problem, but they are in a little town, or they're not somewhere where I can get a bunch of resources. I can have them jump on a virtual meeting or a virtual support group or whatever. And now all these organizations have adapted so that now they're able to work digitally in a way that they had no capacity to do so before. So I think there's just been this huge growth in the ability of organizations to expand and reach more people that need help, because everyone has figured out how to go digital. I think that there's a lot more work that needs to be done there, as far as having access to digital services is also a privilege, because a lot of people that are the most in need don't have an iPhone, don't have a computer, or don't know how to use those devices or access them. So like a big thing that I have pushed for in community centers and here in San Francisco is like having access to digital resources, because while the resources are there, not everyone is able to access them. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
Thank you, Jugal. And Beth, what do you feel are some of the good things that have come out of the pandemic to support your work and support our unhoused community members?
Yeah, to kind of dovetail a bit, I think it's a great one that Jugal mentioned around just technology and the ability to access kind of therapeutic care online has really kind of been a shift for many of us. And also to Alon's point around the ability to be able to acquire permanent supportive housing so quickly. You know, ECS, like I said, is partnering with the city and county for two Home Key sites, and then a third in Marin. But those efforts would have been very challenged because, if not for limits put on CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act. And so I think one of the things that we've learned coming out of Home Key is that, and it's not necessarily a popular community-wide decision by the state of California to limit CEQA litigation to prevent Home Key supportive housing sites to be cited. So this is housing, this is homes for an unhoused, chronically disabled population, and absolutely needed, necessary. And so I think things that occurred and things that we've learned and things that should continue in the future is really kind of looking at laws, zoning that limit the ability for San Francisco and other communities to meet their housing element goals. There's other limits to that, as well as just zoning, and that's financing. But certainly the things that we can control and things that we can do in a way that really, in a determined way, to be able to put more affordable and supportive housing online is really crucial. And I think a lot was done during the pandemic to pave the road and to clear the path, I'll say, for us to site programs much more quickly than we would have ever been able to do. And I think that's absolutely something that was really instrumental. It was a very important tool that was available during the pandemic, and just hoping that these tools to build housing faster and to be able to site them in different communities, right? I think that geographically disperse housing is really important for the future of the state of California, not just San Francisco.
Thank you, Beth. And Shireen, finishing up with you, what do you feel are some of the positive or good things that have come out of the pandemic?
Well, so we've already talked about the housing that's become available and some of the laws that have changed and technology. And I think one thing that was really highlighted during the heart of the pandemic was the incredible inequities in people's experiences with COVID And we know that Black and Brown people in particular were really negatively impacted. Older people were negatively impacted. Children were and continue to be. And I think what that did is it made us get really real about some of the conversations we're having about how we address those. When you think about things like technology and the fact that there's a real digital divide, for instance, and there's been some real strong efforts to start addressing that in a much more meaningful way than what we were doing before the pandemic. I would say we also had a chance to really take a look at food security issues. And we knew that food insecurity was an issue in San Francisco before then. Was 1 in 4 people were food insecure. And then during COVID, it became 37% of our population. So we've really had to think a lot about what models work for people and think about things like food sovereignty. And ultimately, we've had to really shift, and I'm saying this as a system, not as individuals, but as a system, we've had to really shift and center the experiences of people who are really experiencing those disparities and hear from them what works. And I'd say that we've been able to create a lot of models, new models and tweaks to some of our models because the conversation has shifted. And that ultimately, to me, will help lead us to better and greater success, whether we're talking about homelessness or whether we're talking about any other kind of aspect of San Franciscans' lives.
Thank you, Shireen, Alon, Beth, and Jugal for sharing your wonderful work and experience of providing housing and housing services to our unhoused community members. We'll make sure that listeners have information on your website, the research on the latest point of time count, as well as the other research documents that HSH has done, and then links to donate to both Episcopal Community Services program as well as HSH. And I want to wish all of you a happy holiday, what's left of the holiday season, if you will, and please stay safe as we continue on our pathway here through recovery of COVID-19 pandemic and all of its variants. So thanks for participating in the show today.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Voices of the Community. You've been listening to the voices of the Executive Director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing for the City and County of San Francisco, Shireen McSpadden, the Manager of Housing Subsidy Programs at the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, Alan Gutierrez, along with the participant in the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing Flex Housing Pool Program, Jugal Patel, as well as the Executive Director of Episcopal Community Services of San Francisco, Beth Stokes. To find out more about the Flex Housing Pool Program, along with other housing and wraparound support services that the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing for the City and County of San Francisco provides, please go to hsh.org. And for more information about all the wraparound support services that the Episcopal Community Services of San Francisco provides, and to make a donation, please go to ecs-sf.org. We're transitioning this special series on nonprofits, small businesses, and local governments into a new 6-part series focused on our arts and culture organizations along with their workforce. The new series will be highlighting the issues and solutions our arts and culture organizations and their workforce are struggling with to come back from the pandemic, along with addressing the systemic racism in our performing arts ecosystem. The new series will include live in-person community dialogue events that will be streamed, as well as our usual radio show, podcast, and a television show with our friends at Bay Area Video Coalition. Go to georgecoster.com and sign up for our newsletter to participate in the live shows and stay in the loop on our new series. Thank you all for your support during the run of this very important series, spotlighting the work of our nonprofits, small businesses, and our local government during this global pandemic. We hope that you enjoyed the insights, points of view, and personal stories from the voices of changemakers and their nonprofits and small businesses featured in the series. To find out more and get engaged with the nonprofits, small businesses, and staff members featured in the series, please go to my website, georgecoster.com, and click on Voices of the Community to find links to the extended versions of these interviews and to listen to the entire series. After listening to these stories, we hope that you will consider making a donation and volunteering to provide a hand up to your fellow community members. Today's episode was made possible by the audio wizard and our associate producer, Eric Estrada, and the graphics magic of Casey Nance from Citron Studios, along with the wonderful crew at the San Francisco Public Press and KSFP. Voices of the Community is supported by a grant from the James Irvine Foundation, dedicated to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. More at irvine.org. Voices of the Community is a member of Intersection for the Arts, which allows us to offer you a tax deduction for your contributions. Please go to georgecoster.com and click on the donate link to make a donation to help us provide future shows just like this one. While you're on our website, you can enjoy our archived past shows, which feature community voices working on solutions to critical issues facing Northern California communities. And you can sign up for our newsletter to find out more about future shows, as well as shows and events from the organizations that are included in our episodes. Take us along on your next COVID walk by subscribing to Voices of the Community on Apple Podcast, Spotify, and Google Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at George Coster, and we'd love to hear from you with feedback and show ideas, so send us an email to george@georgecoster.com. I'm George Coster in San Francisco, and thank you for listening.